Dan Perkins Media presents a unique and exciting program. Truth Starts Now, a conversation with Dan Perkins. The left has taken away your rights to freedom of speech. Truth Starts Now is a platform for you to regain your voice. America and Americans will be better off if we can have civil and respectful conversations about the day's important issues. Now, here's your host, Dan Perkins.
Welcome to The Truth Starts Now, and we have a gentleman by the name of Lawrence Tracy, and he's a dual kind of guest. He's going to talk to us about his book, and he's going to show us the book in a moment, but he's also going to talk about his experience in Washington, D.C., and his outrage at the Republican reply to the State of the Union. So, Lawrence, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, and make it Larry.
All right, Larry, that's fine.
I never go by Lawrence. Whenever I get a phone call for Lawrence, I figure hang up because it's some sort of a come on. So no one calls me Lawrence.
All right, I'll try to remember, sir. You were in the Army. You retired as a full bird colonel. Tell us a little bit about your career and then put in a commercial for your book.
Well, I came into the Army as a second lieutenant, of course, and I gradually then decided I wanted to leave infantry and go into intelligence. So I transferred into intelligence. And then later on, I learned of a program we had in the Army called the Foreign Area Officer Program. And Latin America was always an interest of mine. When I was in high school, I had been in the Civil Air Patrol and won the Pennsylvania slot for the cadet exchange and went to Venezuela for a week. And that sort of hooked me into Latin America. So I went into the Foreign Area Officer Program and spent a year in, got a master's degree at Georgetown, and then went to Argentina, where I was spent a year traveling all over Argentina and the rest of South America. One interesting thing is the word foreign area officer, we speak in acronyms, and it's called the FAO program. So I was having lunch with a group of Argentine officers describing how I'd just been down on Tierra del Fuego and had traveled around, and finally, this colonel asked me in Spanish, what is this program called that you're in? And speaking in Spanish, but using the American acronym, I said it's called the FAO program. I had forgotten that the word FAO, F-E-O, in Spanish means ugly. So here I am saying foreign area officer, and he's hearing me say the ugly program, because then he said, no, che, está muy lindísimo, bonita este programa. So I never use that acronym anymore.
Good.
But I traveled all around there. And then I went back to Washington to DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. And I was the Argentine analyst. I went up to brief the chairman one day. There were strange things happening in Argentina. And after that briefing had been over, the director of DIA called me aside and he said, why are we wasting you down in the bowels of the Pentagon? You should be running our briefing team. And so that started off on a new career. I guess I had a degree of Irish Blarney, and that's when I started doing the briefing and developing the system that I used in the book that I've written. And I was in charge of the briefing team for Defense Intelligence Agency for 3 years. I was in the process of getting my master's degree. I hadn't finished it yet, and then I did. I wrote my thesis on Bolivia, and lo and behold, the Army then called me and said, we're sending you to Bolivia as Army attaché.
Wow. So
that was fortuitous, because
sure,
as an Army colonel and a lieutenant colonel, I come into the embassy and I know more about Bolivia than any of the foreign service officers, which they are used to thinking the Army attaché should go out and count tanks and artillery and just do that. Yet I knew the politics very well, and I knew some Bolivian politicians. So that was an enjoyable 2 years. I had two elections during that time and two coups, which is standard practice for Bolivia. And interestingly now, the last Bolivian president is in jail, conservative. Does that ring a bell for here in the United States?
Sure.
They did it after it was over. I came back then to the Pentagon, was in the office of the Secretary of Defense, and then got very, very involved in our Central American policy during the Reagan administration. And once again, outspeaking, they sent me to various universities. and I spoke, and it was, as I said, it was a tough audience to face because most of the students that came to these meetings were of a more liberal persuasion. The more conservative students were staying back studying. And so I ran into hostile audiences consistently, and I was frequently escorted onto the stage by campus security. But I always took it as a slight measure of success that I never had to be escorted off the stage. And I think it was a meeting of the minds, as I expressed, and I debated professors whose whole career was in being against military dictatorships. Now they were in the situation, they were supporting a military dictatorship in the Sandinistas. And they had to go through some various interesting mental gymnastics to go and shift gears and do that by pointing out that the Sandinistas were not a military dictatorship. And I said, how come they had the largest army in all of Central America? How come they're all with all those positions? And they squirmed a little bit, and I even had the students laughing on occasion on it. So it was an enjoyable time, and that was my last assignment on active duty. When I left the State Department, I was assigned full time there. So it was an enjoyable career. I had 3 years in Vietnam. And in fact, I met and married my wife in Vietnam. She was the social secretary to the Philippine ambassador. And that's who we met. And I was able to travel all over the country. I read a lot of books on Vietnam before going over. And that made me sort of as a captain, the most knowledgeable person, because everybody else was in for 1 year and then back. And on this, and I went to a lot of time in the Mekong Delta and the Central Highlands as elections were approaching. My final assignment in Vietnam, you might be interested in, I was an advisor to General Nguyen Ngoc Luan. That name may ring a bell. He was the general whose photograph executing a Viet Cong war criminal who had just been responsible for the killing of 35 Vietnamese police officials, their wives and family, and he and I got to know each other very well. There were a lot of VIPs coming in to see our organization, which was using computers to track the bad guys, and I always went to General Luan to get his input and sometimes have him come to the briefing, and then we reunited back here in Washington or in Washington. And one time we were having a beer, and I said, "General, I never ask you this question. Why'd you shoot the guy?" And he just, without a bat, he said, "Very bad man." And he explained the same story that I had learned from intelligence, and I had also learned from the AP photographer who took the picture, Eddie Adams, won the Pulitzer Prize for that. And Eddie had followed Luan around the country and confirmed it. So, but Luan was really castigated by people here in the United States, or by the press especially.
So you're,
So that's sort of Vietnam and Latin America were basically my career.
but what happened that caused you to develop this strategy that you ultimately put in a book?
I just felt that I had to not depend on my Irish blarney, which had got me through so much, but I had to have some sort of a system that I could put all this new complex information into. And I trained my team as well to do it that way. First of all, what was the bottom line we wanted to get across to the chairman in this case or in other situations? Then back up from there and look, how do you introduce the subject? And then you fill it in with the area, and then the practicing, the murder board. It's something we bring from the military. It's an intense rehearsal. It's where you face the tough questions in practice, so you can answer those tough questions in the real practice, and you can do it, and don't get flustered. And if you don't know the answer, learn to say, "I don't know. I'll get that for you," because we never wanted to go and try to fake our way out through the chairman. This was far too important for our own ego. We had to go and give the exact information. The chairman asked a question, and I said, "I don't know, General. We'll get that information." And we came back. DIA just turned itself upside down to get as much information as he can. I would take it by noon the next morning to the colonel, that it was his special aide. And if we didn't have the information, I'd say, "We're working on it." And that satisfied them. They realized in intelligence, you can't answer every question, but you can't fake your way out. That's what you cannot do.
I was fortunate enough and still fortunate enough to manage money for individuals in a private practice. And I was involved in the late 70s in developing investment products for Wall Street. When you're dealing with investment products, you deal with portfolio managers. As I traveled around the country talking to portfolio managers that we were considering hiring to run different portfolios for this investment, I was shocked at the inability of these people to communicate to other people. It's like they were living in a different world. And so don't bother me with questions. I know what I'm doing. And we would say, but you're going to have to talk to people, and they're going to have to be able to understand you. And so I put many, many portfolio managers at various money management companies, not in your program, but in the program that I developed of how to be a more effective communicator. Yet I see today terrible, terrible communication skills. And whether they're politicians, members of the military, the press, whatever they are, our level of sharing, it's no wonder we don't like each other because we can't share ideas with each other. We can't articulate what it is that we believe. And in many cases, we don't give the person we're trying to convince the opportunity to disagree respectfully. That's one of the reasons why I started this show so many years ago was I wanted to create an environment where people who had different philosophies could come on the show and have a conversation with me, and I would treat them with respect, and they would treat me with respect. And I said, always tell people, if you screw up, you're off. I'm cutting off your microphone. You're done. I mean, I haven't had to do that yet, but I just am amazed at the inability of so many elected officials who can't string sentences together and make sense.
Now that's certainly true. And in my book, one of the quotations I have, which I always used, was from Lee Iacocca, and in one of his books, and he said, "I find it always a shame when a brilliant engineer cannot explain to a board or a committee what's in his head." And Iacocca put a lot of emphasis on that. Technical people, those who are in IT, are going to. I'm definitely not an IT person. And I have to have things explained to me, sort of basically what it means. My son-in-law is a German, and he develops he they live here in the United States, but he develops algorithms for Siemens, and he does it all remotely. And he was explaining to me what he did. In fact, he showed me. He said, "Do you want to read my dissertation?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to." So I looked it up, and I turned page after page, and I said, "Patrick, there aren't any words in here. It was nothing but mathematical formula." And he said with his German accent, "Yeah, I thought you'd say that." And but he communicates with his people, and they can do it. But how about for the lay people? That's how you have to be able to do it. And when you're trying to explain foreign policy, you're dealing with abstractions and complexities, and it's difficult for some people, plus biases that people already have. Right now, it's difficult to communicate that the way the when country is so evenly divided. And my children, I must admit, my daughters are all on the left side and just think that I'm sort of, how in the world could you support that man, Trump? And I said, look at what the government was like when he was president. Look at what the government is like now. What are you paying for gas, for food, et cetera? But that then is logic that breaks up against
Right.
bias and emotional feelings.
Oh, Colonel, we're going to take a break here for some commercial messages, and we'll be right back speaking with Larry Tracy about the book. And hold up the cover so we can see it as we go into break.
Well, I'll just say that we are in a period that I think, and I saw that on your previous program. I think one of the great dangers is the electronic grid. I
Yeah.
think that is our Achilles heel of Achilles heels, and something has to be done because with one stroke, we could be powerless and nothing else counts.
Right. We'll be back with Larry T Tracy after these messages.
I'm Dan Perkins, the author of a new historical romance novel called Sad Eyes. It is a story of a young woman, a beautiful Irish lass with red hair, green eyes, and curves that won't quit. She is born in 1912 in Waterloo, Iowa. She decides she wants to be an ER nurse, but she wants to move away from Waterloo to the excitement of the big city. She is accepted at St. James School of Nursing in Chicago and began a life as a true American patriot, serving her country in two wars. She fell in love with the love of her life. She takes the longest honeymoon in history. This novel is full of twists and turns and is difficult to put down. You can find Sad Eyes at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and jcarrollpublishing.com or through your local bookstore. Get it, read it, tell people about it, and write a review on Amazon. This is Dan Perkins.
Welcome back to The Truth Starts Now, and we're with Larry Tracy, not Lawrence anymore, Larry Tracy, who's got a book. Can you hold up the book so we can see the cover?
I certainly will. It's called How to Bring Home the Bacon, and I don't know how I came upon that title. It's just that it's part of the American idiom. From what I know, it goes back to our agrarian times when farmers had to hire itinerant workers, but they didn't have the money to pay them until they sold the crop, and the itinerant workers' families would remind their person going off to work, remember to bring home the bacon. That's probably as good a story as any as the reason for it. Okay. And I've advised the publisher to please not send it outside of the United States and Canada right now, because in Canada, they also understand it. But this would not sell well over in the Middle East.
Probably not. Probably not.
Bacon. So I'll do another one. It's out now on print. It's a company in New Jersey called Book Baby. I hate the title, but it's somehow connected with a parent company in Seattle, Washington called CD Baby. And they have very wide distribution. I had published this previously on Amazon, just myself, a formatter and an editor. And it just didn't sell well. It could have been in the witness protection program for that, because Amazon doesn't advertise that well. But on this one, I think it will. And on the ebook will go out sometime in, I think it's the 17th or 18th of April.
Are you pricing it?
I got the book here. It's at $17.95, and then the ebook is $9.99. And whichever way it will go, it seems to be a fair price for the value that is in there. The key thing about selling a book is just getting people to decide they want to listen. Oh, then I will, after this goes, I'll do an audio book. Now, Book Baby can do it with automatic intelligence or artificial intelligence. Right. And I just don't want to do that. I want my Philadelphia accent to be heard clearly, that this is done being read by the author himself.
Okay.
Some sort of a feedback, that would be a way to do it. But it's good. And the reason I did this, Dan, was I wanted people, I know that public speaking is the number one fear in the United States. And that sounds to be a little strange. But in all the seminars I did after I retired from the Army, and I did that, I found people, they would be put into the seminar by their company, by their human resources. When they found out they were going to have to make a practice presentation, they never came back on it because that. And I think you have to be able to practice. You have to be able to react to an audience, your body language, your facial expression, how you react to criticism. I was getting criticism all the time when I was out speaking for the Reagan administration on Central America. But I never let it get to me to the point that I'd lose my cool. I would, but I wouldn't joke too much about it because you don't want your audience to think that you're taking their concerns frivolously.
Right.
So you have to respect it on there, as you pointed out, mutual respect. And I could understand why they would take that position. I would say I can understand, given what you have heard here in the classroom and what has been in the New York Times and other places. But here is some factual data, and do that so students could make their judgment on what it was. I felt that what we were doing in Central America was morally correct and politically correct, and that we were keeping them from communist government such as Cuba. I'm giving a talk next week to a group on the Cuban Missile Crisis that took place back in 62. I'd done talks on that before. I was a lieutenant when that occurred, and I tried to get into the invasion. The invasion, of course, that never occurred. And it was a good thing it didn't, because 30 years later, we learned out our intelligence was so horrible at that time that the Soviets had put in 30 tactical nuclear weapons, which would have caused thousands of Americans to be killed, would have caused President Kennedy to launch the missiles. We would have been in a nuclear war. Nobody wins a nuclear war. So
Right.
that's always been a fascination for me, the decision-making process and the errors that were made. And we came within a couple of instances within minutes of a nuclear war, and that's how bad it would be.
Right. I was thinking about what you were saying, and we were talking about, we haven't used the word, but it's a word that is used a lot, and that's communication skill. Not only do you have to know how to speak, what to say, how to say it, when not to say something, when to be controversial, when to not be controversial. All that comes with practice and experience.
That's right.
And you have to make some mistakes. But I'm really concerned that what we have in our country today is a crop of politicians should never have been elected. We have a vice president who is famous for her word salads that nobody can figure out what in the hell she's saying. And this is a woman who, when asked, was she ready to take over the presidency? Yes. Well, what task has she, since she's been vice president, that she's been given by Joe Biden, what task has she completed? None.
No, the border. She was the border czar, and she's never been.
Right. Then you look at the president, you look at Biden, and you look at, I saw this clip this afternoon, 35 times that Biden has lied to the American people in the last year, 35 times. And it's like he doesn't care that he's lying to the American people. And the Democratic Party knows he's lying, but they don't care.
I wonder if there will be sometime between now and November a group of elder statesmen of the Democrats, whoever they may be, will go and visit Joe Biden as Barry Goldwater and others did to Nixon in 1974 and say, pack it in, you're finished. The other thing that I've always wondered, and that would be the dilemma that the Democrats will face if Biden dies in office. At that point, Kamala Harris automatically is president of the United States, and she is almost automatically the candidate. And that is probably something that is bothersome to them, and they don't know how to solve it. I just do not think, Dan, that Biden is going to be the candidate. I just think they have to look at the numbers and say these things are not lying. They're changing. He's just at lowest approval rating. And the one poll that election after election choose truthful and accurate is the right track, wrong track of the country. And it has been down in the 30s and low 40s for maybe even lower than that for almost the entire time of his administration. And in a normal year, he could not win. But of course, they're going after Trump. In the courtrooms, they're trying to do it, and if they could throw him in jail, they would want to do that, and they would see that. So I think the Democrats are in a bad shape, but the one skill that they have, they're not very good at governing, but they are good at slipping votes in where there did not exist before, and I think that's the thing that Republicans cannot ignore. We have to take advantage of the early voting. I know my wife and I will vote the first day that early voting is allowed in Maryland, where we live. Not going to do it on the election day, November, what is it, 5th? That we're going to vote right away, and I hope a lot of Republicans do the same thing, to vote early.
I think, but I do think that the Republicans, by and large, don't know how to win,
Maybe.
and they can't take their success if they do win. I mean, Mitt Romney had Barack Obama on the ropes in the second debate, and never followed through.
Now, I remember
He
that.
could have been president, but he never followed through. The Republicans historically don't want to offend anybody.
I
The
think you're
Democrats
right.
don't care who they offend because it's all about winning the election. That's what they want to do. I don't know who Mr. Trump is going to pick as his vice president. There's a whole list of them, and one of them was the woman who did the re Republican reply to Joe Biden's State of the Union address. I didn't see any substance there. Did
Oh,
you?
no, and it missed the point. I felt, I will admit, I preferred DeSantis to Trump. I just felt that Trump had so much baggage and DeSantis had much of the same policy, but without the baggage. And the fact that he had, I always admired DeSantis for the fact that when he graduates from Yale Law School, he could have gone into any law firm at a couple hundred thousand. Instead, he joins the Navy and he becomes an advisor to SEAL Team One. That shows me something about his character. Of course, he has already said he would not be the vice presidential candidate. The other two are also from Florida. That's the constitutional problem we have. We have Senator Rubio and Mayor Suarez. Mayor Suarez's aunt lives in Maryland, isn't a good friend of ours, so we're sort of prejudiced towards him. I think he'd be a terrific vice president. But how do they handle that? That Florida, that two from the same state. One would be that Trump would go back and claim his residence to be New York State, with what New York State is trying to do now. I don't know if he'd ever want to do that.
No. First of all, I would say in response to your statement there, if we had two candidates like we had with Bush and Cheney, the person who moves is the vice president, not the president. You're not going to say, Mr. President, you got to move so we can keep Cheney on the ticket. No, Mr. Cheney, you got to move. And he went to
That's
Wyoming.
right. And so I think the two Floridians, as well qualified as they are not, and DeSantis has taken himself out. So who else would be the next candidate that I would want would be Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. Biden is already losing black votes, and the Hispanic votes are. The Hispanics and I, being a Spanish speaker and having lived in Latin America, I've got a lot of friends from Latin America. They are basically conservative. They're family oriented. And I think they're going to come over more and more. And they are the ones that I've talked to are absolutely disgusted at this border crisis. They came in, they went through the process for citizenship or green card, and they see these people rushing in the border, which is. And then the administration has the audacity to say the border is secure. No country can survive with a border like that. And one other point on that, as I see the young Chinese men that are coming in carrying rather expensive luggage, first of all, they got out of China. That shows Chinese government complicity. They all seem very fit. Maybe it's just the nature of the ethic, but I just wonder if there are not special ops people being sent in from to support terrorism, which is the area you know so well, in the event of a war with China.
That's a possibility, but I think there's another issue that has a lot of weight, and that is the problem of China's government to grow its economy. These young men that are coming are out of work. These are highly educated young men and women who were working, but because of the collapse of the Chinese economy, and they're talking about maybe 3% growth. This is an economy for years grew at 7.5 to 9% because they needed that volume of GDP in order to be able to find work for the ever-growing population. Well, what's happening is that the ever-growing population is not ever-growing. They're down to the second largest community in the world behind India, and they've lost something like 300 to 500,000 citizens have either left the country or died, and they're expect by 2050 to be a diminished economy and a diminished country. So their power is going to be short-lived, but we do have a situation where we have people in leadership positions around the world who don't know what they're doing and are being led by radicals, communists, whatever, who don't have any idea what they're doing either, and what is the outcome. I just talked to somebody recently on a show And I said, we've got in the United States and around the world, we've got the Green New Dealers who want to reduce CO2 emissions. What they're not recognizing is that if you continue to cut CO2 emissions, millions, if not billions, of people are going to die because without CO2 at a certain level, plants cannot grow, can't grow food. So I think there's a lot of issues that we could talk about. Let me see the cover of the book one more time.
Well, let me also give you the way to be able to get it online.
Okay.
And it's very simple. It's store, STORE dot bookbaby dot com. And then when you come to the search page, just type in my name. You don't have to type that whole title and just put in Larry Tracy, and that'll bring you to the page right away. And it shows what the philosophy is of the book, and what I hope is my own credibility of doing this, of having used it in the real world, and it worked for me, and it would work for them.
Good. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Dan.
My pleasure also. We'll be right back after these messages.